Welcome to the U.S. Court of Appeals. I'm honored to sit this week with my two brilliant colleagues, Judges Engelhardt and Douglas. This is day two of our three-day sitting, so we're first going to hear today. It is 25-40272, right? That's the case? Okay, I think what threw me off was your first name. Okay, because it's Christian, but spelled with a K. And I thought, are they sitting at the wrong table? I wasn't sure. Okay, so U.S. v. Luna, Mr. Amundson, take it away.
Christian Amundson for the United States, and may it please the court. Defendant Luna was charged in a one-count indictment with possession of a weapon as a felon based on a predicate conviction for simple possession of drugs. So when this case was briefed, the case law has sort of shifted. So just to be clear as to what sort of arguments we can sort of raise today, one, we argued in our brief that anyone convicted of simple possession of drugs should be able to be disarmed consistent with the Second Amendment. That argument was rejected in this court's case, Hembry. We also argued that contraband laws in consideration with tobacco regulations historically would justify penalized with death at the time of the founding would also justify disarmament. Sort of the logic of Hembry discussing the contraband laws in this court's subsequent decision in Güenwellez, which also considered how tobacco laws, which were not raised in Hembry, would feed into that analysis, sort of effectively forecloses that argument as well. Nevertheless, the government maintains that Mr. Luna can be disarmed. First, we see, based on going arms...
Counsel, if you would add to your list of cases, Kimball and DeBrow, most recently, mm-hmm. those would be cases that I'd like to hear you distinguish mm-hmm. or discuss. Sure.
So, sort of, the government sees a sort of logical through line, starting with Bullock into Schnorr into Kimball. Bullock basically started with a factual case of a defendant who had a violent felony offense for misusing a firearm, and this court looked at the historical record and said that firearm regulations from the history indicate that if you use a firearm to commit violence, you can be disarmed. And I would note that Bullock was charged with aggravated assault, which includes the use of a dangerous weapon. But this court looked at the fact that Mr. Bullock had used a firearm specifically, and the only way to do that would have been to get to the facts of the underlying predicate. In Schnorr, this court sort of extrapolated on Bullock and the going arms law and found that an individual who commits violent acts even without a firearm can be disarmed. And then we get to Kimball, and Kimball was faced with a different issue in some respect. What do you do in the circumstance where a defendant has a predicate conviction for a felony that doesn't necessarily include violence, but is such of the type that it's intrinsically violent in nature? And Kimball looked at laws related to the categorical disarmament of certain individuals from the founding, religious dissidents, political dissidents, and determine that if you belong to a category based on your predicate offense, you can be disarmed. And it determined that drug traffickers specifically can be disarmed. And one way to determine that someone is a drug trafficker is if they have a conviction for a trafficking offense, which is what Mr. Kimball had. The government thinks another way in which you can prove that someone is a drug trafficker is to go to their, if they've been convicted of possession, to go to their possession offense and look at the underlying conduct to see if you were possessing those drugs for your personal use or were you possessing them for trafficking. And in our view, Mr. Luna was possessing the drugs to traffic them because the facts underlying his predicate show he was arrested with methamphetamine in a car in a backpack that contained his ID, which had a ledger, which include prices of narcotics and the amounts of monies that were owed to him. It also, the ledger also included detailed information on how to commit counterfeit identity theft and forgery crimes. And I think that's relevant because when he was arrested for the conduct underlying the G1 offense, he was found to be trying to commit identity theft at a car dealership. So I think the predicate's factual basis shows that that backpack, in fact, belonged to Mr. Luna, that Luna was trafficking the methamphetamine, and therefore, because he's a drug trafficker, Kimball says drug traffickers can be disarmed, and therefore, Mr. Luna can be disarmed. And again, I think that this is sort of the, I know that there's been case law since that sort of tries to struggle with exactly what the implication of Kimball is, because Kimball talks about getting rid of what was referred to as an individualized assessment, and it rejects a case that's out of the Third Circuit called Pisolatidis v. Barr. But Pisolatidis v. Barr is talking about specifically a dangerousness assessment that's based off of a litany of conduct, including felony convictions and misdemeanor convictions, and conduct that did not result in charges. And this court, sort of going back all the way to Conley, has expressed hesitation about employing a sort of amorphous dangerousness standard where it's unclear exactly what would it would not be dangerous, and the trial courts are doing ad hoc determinations as to whether or not a defendant is dangerous. That is different than the argument I'm putting forward here, where this court has said, however, you can assess whether the individual is violent, whether they're involved in an intrinsically violent activity, and the conduct underlying Mr. Luna's felony conviction demonstrates that he was involved in an intrinsically violent activity, in other words, drug trafficking. So based on sort of that reading of the case law, the case law is consistent, and it justifies Mr. Luna's disarmament under 922 G1. And then just to add on Kimball does talk about categorical disarmament, but that's doesn't necessarily mean history supports both categorical disarmament under the laws analyzed in Kimball, laws that if you belong to a group, you're automatically disarmed. But the laws that are related under Schnoor are more targeted to what was your prior conduct. So history supports both categorical disarmament and individualized disarmament, and it is under the individualized disarmament that Mr. Luna can be disarmed. The other point that we are proffering as to why Mr. Luna can be disarmed is because he was under indictment for a different offense at the time that he possessed this firearm. And just to clarify, because I think the timeline can be a little bit confusing, he was arrested initially for possessing a firearm and drugs in 2021. He was indicted in state court for the possession of the firearm in April of 2022. In May of 2022, he's arrested on this offense. And then he's indicted for the drug possession from that original 2021 offense in June. So at the time of the May offense, which is the underlying G1, he was only under indictment for possession of a firearm. Nevertheless, when you step back and think from first principles, what an as-applied challenge is, an as-applied challenge is specific to the facts and circumstance of the particular defendant. So from our perspective, this is not a Second Amendment challenge by a defendant who is a felon. It is a Second Amendment challenge by a defendant who is a felon who is under indictment. And there is a historical tradition of disarming individuals who are under indictment. This court already did most of that analysis in Juarez, where it reviewed cases that held that if you were held at the founding under after being indicted, you were held and sort of could not possess a firearm because you were in pretrial.
He was not separately charged under 922N, though, correct?
Correct. He was not. So the government's view is that he could not have been, because 922N does not criminalize simple possession. It only charges receipt and transfer, and Mr. Luna is charged strictly with possession. However, in Chiores, the court noted that the historical laws support disarmament for simple possession, because if you're being held pretrial, that necessarily means you can't possess a firearm. And so in that sense, the historical tradition as applied to 922N is broader than what 922N criminalizes. But 922G1 does criminalize possession. And when you look at the fact that he was under indictment, the historical tradition supports him being disarmed because of all of the analysis that was done in Juarez. And I think even in Juarez, the court noted that the justifications for those laws are the same justifications that were identified in Diaz as the justifications for disarmament under 922G1.
Was that argument made before the district court granted the motion to dismiss the indictment?
Once Juarez came out, we filed an advisory that Mr. Luna was under indictment, and that Juarez supported his disarmament.
What about the other things about his underlying, the state conduct, state convictions that you mentioned at the outset of your argument? Were those argued before the district court granted the motion to dismiss?
So initially we had argued that Mr. Luna could be disarmed because of the fact that he was convicted of possession, and we noted that he had been charged with trafficking. The documents that we relied on to show that he was trafficking were not introduced to the court at the time that the initial decision was issued. I think there was some confusion, and I think a lot of district courts were struggling with confusion as to exactly what could or could not be considered under Diaz, because this was very early in the case law. And so I do know that, like, at the hearing, the district court wasn't even sure it could look into those facts. And when it issued the decision denying, granting the motion to dismiss, it noted that, like, it was unclear whether dangerousness was even an appropriate standard to look at. And it wasn't really until Schnorr that the particular arguments that we are making were sort of came through, like, the law became clear that that these arguments could be made and were appropriate. And that was after the motion to dismiss was granted, after the motion to reconsider was filed with the attachments. And then we filed another advisory to the court that Schnorr had come down. And even implicitly in the motion to, when the court denied the motion to reconsider, it initially stated that it wasn't going to consider the facts underlying the predicate. But then it went to Schnorr and said, well, Schnorr involved a crime where the predicate involved the use of a the use of violence, and that's not the situation. So implicitly, it had to have been looking at the facts that were provided prior in order to make the determination that this predicate did not involve violence.
So this court is going to hear in January, I know you're aware, the court's going to hear en banc the Squire case. Mm-hmm. Would that have any impact whatsoever on this case, do you think?
I don't believe so, because my understanding is that the Squire case is limited to the Commerce Clause challenge, and it was not proffered as, like, an alternative basis for affirmal in this case, so it wouldn't have any implication.
All right.
And then just, again, our view is sort of that whether or not these issues were before the district court, this court's jurisprudence in this area shows that, one, it can consider new analogs on appeal, and two, it can take judicial notice of court documents to discuss what the nature of the underlying predicate offense is. So in some ways, it's academic, because this court could just do itself what could consider those documents itself, even if they weren't presented before the district court. Unless the court has any further questions with me, I would get back the rest of my time.
We'll see you back on rebuttal.
Yes, thank you.
All right, we'll hear from Ms. Braver on behalf of Mr. Luna.
Thank you. Rachel Braver for Mr. Luna, and may it please the court. Your Honors, we are asking that you affirm the district court's dismissal of the indictment against Mr. Luna. We will address the government's arguments relating both to the Kimball-Hembree strain of cases and the arguments that they make about being under indictment. Though, as a preliminary matter, and maybe in answer to Judge Engelhardt's question, we argue that the district court did not abuse its discretion in denying the government's request to consider additional facts regarding the ancillary circumstances of the predicate felony. The government, in its opening argument, suggests that the district court was confused about what documents it could look at in considering the motion. And in the hearing, that is true. The district court did say, what is it that we look at? Do we look at these things? Do we look at these things? And at that moment, the government had not presented additional evidence regarding the facts and circumstances of the underlying predicate. And at that time, the government didn't ask for additional time to do so. And then the court ruled on the motion. And then it was only after the court issued its ruling that the government then came forward with this additional information. And so we're arguing that the district court did not abuse its discretion, and in light of that, this court should not consider those facts. However, it is our position that whether or not the district court abused its discretion, this court can't consider those facts regardless because of Kimball and Hembree and Banuelos and Devereaux. So we argue that that case law precludes consideration of those facts. The government just told this court that it believes that separate from a conviction of drug trafficking, there is another way to look at underlying conduct to see if there was trafficking going on. But Hembree rejects that squarely. Banuelos, interpreting Hembree, similarly rejects that. And Devereaux, kind of by analogy, rejects that as well. Sounds like this court is very familiar at this point with Kimball. I know members of this panel wrote that were involved in the Henry decision, so I won't belabor that. But as this court knows, Henry was indicted for possession. Henry was indicted for possession of a controlled substance, possession with intent to distribute, and I believe, Henry was indicted for possession of a controlled substance and possession with intent to distribute. And in that case, Henry had pleaded guilty only to the possession of the controlled substance. And this court said that evidence of a potential greater charge does not support the government's historical reasoning because our binding case law restricts us to reviewing only Henry's predicate conviction, possession of methamphetamine. Because there was the indictment for possession with intent to distribute, I think we can assume that there was some evidence of trafficking in that case. But Henry does not suggest that if there had been facts supporting the possession with intent to distribute charge, that the outcome might have been different. Instead, Henry says, following Kimball, we can only review the predicate conviction. Banuelos and this recent case, Debro, confirm that. In Banuelos, there were facts that were heavily suggestive of possession with intent to distribute. I think the pure quantity alone was some many, many pounds of marijuana. But the court says, no, we're not going to look at that.
What about counsel's argument about disarming someone in connection with an indictment? And I assume he means pretrial as a provision of a bond, for lack of a better word, someone who is under indictment and is disarmed pending trial.
Yes, we would argue that this court's case law in Quiros is inapplicable to the present circumstances, that the government has not shown a tradition of pretrial disarmament as applied to Mr. Luna's particular circumstances, both because we think that the 922G1 is the wrong vehicle for doing that, and because of the alleged conduct supporting the indictment. So in Quiros, this court found that there was a historical tradition of disarming some defendants while awaiting trial. And in particular, in that case, Mr. Quiros had been indicted for burglary, which the court noted in many jurisdictions was a capital offense at the time of the founding. And so he would have been detained, not released on pretrial, and would have been disarmed. Also different in Quiros, as this court raised some questions about, Judge Douglas, that was a 922N case, for receiving or shipping a firearm while under indictment. And that's not what we have here. And as counsel noted, 922N does require more than what the government is saying Mr. Luna did here, which is possessing a firearm while under indictment. 922N requires knowledge of the indictment and receiving and shipping or transporting the firearm while knowingly under indictment. In that case, Mr. Quiros had already been found guilty. And I think it was the case that the day that he was found guilty was the day that Bruin came down, and so afterwards, his lawyer filed the motion to dismiss. But because he had already been found guilty, there was no question about knowledge or receipt, and so no findings outside the record were required. But here we don't have that. I'm a little stiffly today. Quiros notes and Contreras notes Quiros in particular notes that not all crimes resulted in pretrial detention, and Contreras says that not all felonies are created equal. So it may be the case that defendants in the founding era were detained pretrial and thus could be disarmed if they were indicted for burglary. But here we have Mr. Luna, who at the time was only indicted for felon in possession of a firearm. He wasn't indicted for, until later, the possession of a controlled substance, and he was never indicted for possession with intent to distribute a controlled substance. The government, in its briefing, suggests that there is evidence of possession with intent to distribute, but we would argue that the facts there are debatable, and that there was evidence that the scales, et cetera, that might suggest distribution belongs to the other person in the car. I think in the government's briefing, they also suggest that, and I know that counsel didn't go into this just now, but the, in their briefing, they suggest that Giglio and Contreras also provide support for being able to disarm anybody, or Mr. Luna in particular, while being under indictment. But those cases are also inapplicable. Giglio and Contreras dealt with somebody who was still under criminal justice sentence, who was on supervised release, who had already been found guilty. There was no presumption of innocence at issue. And importantly, the cases say, Giglio in particular says that the holding turns on the fact that he was on supervised release and that the court there did not need to look at any dismissed charges, convictions for crimes not punishable by more than a year, or convictions stemming from the same indictment. Instead, all that the court needed to know was precisely from the same evidence, the individual's prior felony conviction, which is different from what we have here. So we would argue that that does not squarely map on, and that is also supported by Diaz, where this court has said not to consider outside evidence. I'd briefly like to return to our arguments for why Kimball and Hembury in that tradition foreclosed the government's argument. I think I briefly discussed Banuelos. I think it was just 2 weeks ago that Debro was decided. And in that case, it was a different predicate. It was a aggravated destruction of property predicate, but there was other conduct that was alleged that was not the offense of conviction. And there, the government argued dangerousness again based on the underlying facts. And the court expresses concerns about, one, the workability of looking into those facts, but also says that information is precluded by case law. I will note that the facts that the government wanted to get into there were facts relating to evading arrest. And the government here hasn't argued in Mr. Kimball's indictment when he pleaded guilty to the possession of controlled substance, there was the trafficking felony that was also indicted that he did not plead guilty to. And also there was an evading arrest charge that he did not plead guilty to. And in Debro, similarly, the government argued that there was this evading conduct, and the court said, no, we do not look at that. So I think similarly here, where there was that evading charge as part of the indictment, this court should similarly, like in Debro, not consider that information. The government has talked a little bit about some prior case law before Kimball, including Bullock and Schnur. And I just want to differentiate those cases from what we have. Essentially, this court has identified several different strains of when 922 G1 is constitutional. Of course, starting with Diaz and the theft punishable by death at the founding strain. And I think ultimately Bullock and Schnur kind of are in the second strain of that, where there is actual violence. And in those cases, the court does look to, and I know the government also cited Morgan and Betancourt. In some cases, the court has looked to facts necessary to support a conviction. But some cases, it seems, do so more to illustrate than rather make necessary. And in those cases, they don't look at ancillary conduct beyond what was necessary to support the conviction. But I think our first argument is that those cases are in a different strain of why 922 G1 was constitutional in those circumstances. I think finally, even if the court decided to consider additional facts, which we argue again is that is not consistent with the case law, but even if this court were to, there is this open question of what the standard is and how to prove it. This court in many decisions has expressed concern with how to do that. Are they mini trials? Are you looking at Shepherd documents sufficient to support the categorical approach? From our perspective, would the defense be able to put on any evidence? What is required for discovery? So that is kind of a whole nother can of worms that is unsettled at this point. But even if the court did want to reach the additional conduct here, our argument is that the facts here are not sufficient to prove, by whichever standard the court were to determine was appropriate, that this offense involved distribution. First of all, in looking at the additional documents that were provided after the first district court's order, Mr. Luna did not make an admission when he was arrested that he possessed with the intent to distribute the contraband. He ultimately pleaded nolo contendere, no contest, to the possession charge itself. And I know the government in its briefing has highlighted some of the language in this stipulation about the evidence is true and correct, and how the evidence may be, or the documents may be considered as part of the statement of facts. But as argued in our briefing, we think that there is a reasonable dispute about what Mr. Luna was in fact admitting to. True and correct, I think, reasonably means that the documents themselves were authentic, not necessarily that the information contained in the documents was true and correct. Similar with may be considered as part of a statement of facts. Nowhere does the stipulation say, and Mr. Luna agrees with all the facts and inferences therein. Alternatively, Mr. Luna may have admitted to the facts, but not necessarily the inferences from those facts. So there are many ways to read those facts. For example, the officer says that it's his opinion that the amount, which I think was 6 grams, was consistent with distribution, and Mr. Luna may have acknowledged that the officer said that, but not necessarily acknowledging the inference from that, which is that it is true. But again, this court does not have to decide that, because based on Kimball and Hembree and Banuelos and Debro, this court does not, under its case law, look into that additional information. Unless the court has any questions, we are...
You used the phrase can of worms earlier, and I think you used the word unsettled, which I think is apt, charitable maybe even. But putting forfeiture aside and all that, I think you would agree there is some tension in our 922 G1 cases about what facts courts may consider. Fair to say?
Yes, but yes. I'm happy to respond more.
You can elaborate if you want.
I would like to, yes. I think there is some tension, yes. Though, I think since Kimball, there is this strain of cases where if something is inherently dangerous, we don't look at facts. And if something doesn't fall into a different strain and we have decided is not inherently different, not inherently dangerous, we also don't look at facts. So I think there are some other strains where there is a question about what facts we look into, like the 922G3 set of cases, the Contreras and Mitchell and Connolly, and then also the dangerousness ones where sometimes we do look at the facts. But in this strain where it's not inherent, where because it's outside of Kimball, which is drug trafficking conviction, where we don't look at facts, we don't look at facts. And I will just note, and I think the court has additional questions, but I do want to highlight an important part about Kimball, which is in Kimball there was a dissent, and the dissent raised the question of dangerousness and suggested that possession with intent to distribute or drug trafficking might not have actually a dangerous element, and shouldn't we do an individualized consideration. And the majority said, no, we don't look at facts. So I think that in this strain, while it might be unsettled in some other areas, it is clear that in here we don't look at the facts.
You have a take on Judge Englehart's question about the impact, if any, of Squire?
I think
probably... It's all just speculation at this point. But.
The government is correct. We did make the argument at the district court level, and so it's preserved. It was not... the district court granted our motion to dismiss, and so didn't rule on the Commerce Clause option. I think for our purposes, that would be preserved if this court did not affirm the district court, but I don't think that the open question has any bearing on this case.
Okay, Ms. Braver, thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
just on the point of the tension in the case law, I think it depends on how the court chooses to read Kimball. We read Kimball as saying that if you have been convicted of certain felony offenses, you fall into a category that can be disarmed regardless of whether or not there was violence involved in your specific instance. Because there are laws from history that allow categorical disarmament where there is like an irrebuttable presumption that you are dangerous because you're engaging in an act that is intrinsically tied to violence. That doesn't necessarily foreclose that if you have a conviction where maybe you don't, as a category, justify disarmament, which is what this court said in Hembry as to simple possession, that nevertheless you can look to the facts for clarity as to whether or not you nevertheless should still be disarmed. There is sort of a litany of cases that came out after Schnoor, Betancourt, Kendall, Mitchell, Morgan, Reyes, Simpsons, that look at the underlying facts. If it is the case that Kimball says you can never look at underlying facts in any 922G1, then those cases are directly contradictory. I think the way to read the case law so that it is sort of makes more sense is just to say that if you have a felony conviction that categorically makes you dangerous or categorically makes you violent, you don't look at the facts. If it's ambiguous, you can look to the facts for clarity. And if it turns out when you look at the facts underlying specifically the predicate conviction, not other sort of facts, if there's sufficient proof that you are, in this case, a drug trafficker, you can be disarmed, consistent with the Second Amendment.
And just circle, if you would, circle back briefly to the forfeiture point, because I really want to hear again just your best articulation of why this court can consider the trafficking evidence that the government first dropped in on reconsideration in the district court.
So I would say, following what this court did in Mitchell, which is a case that actually came out against the government, where the defendant was charged with, his predicate was G3, unlawful possession of a firearm, as a drug user, this court took judicial notice of the PSR underlying that predicate conviction and then use the facts to determine whether or not that the individual could be disarmed under sort of de novo review.
Am I correct? The government's opening brief here in our court cited all the reconsideration evidence. But unless I missed it, you never argued that the district court abused its discretion by not considering that evidence.
Correct. Because our view is that under sort of de novo review of a Second Amendment as applied challenge, this court can look at these documents regardless whether they were in front of the district court or not, which is what this court said in Mitchell. So that's why what I meant earlier when I said it's largely academic. I think at the end of the day, this court can consider them and it should consider them. And I just note on Mitchell, but I think Mitchell is probably the one that demonstrates my understanding of Kimball is the closest, even though we lost in that case, because the court said G3 is a nonviolent offense, and then said there's nothing from the facts of that predicate that indicate that the defendant was involved with violence. So it did the analysis, as I'm proposing, that you start with the felony offense as a category, and if the answer is, well, not all, like, if once you determine that maybe that doesn't categorically justify your disarmament, you can nevertheless go to the facts of only the predicate and make a determination as to whether or not there's something in those facts that justify disarmament. Okay. So we would ask that the district court's order dismissing the indictment be reversed.
Okay. Thank you very much. Appreciate the arguments of counsel. The case is under advisement.